Chapter 31 is the chapter where Job defends himself with something like 17 proclamations of his righteousness or the life he led before he was ruined by Satan. And one of the proclamations was that when his enemy had a misfortune, he didn't gloat over his enemy. And I referred to Romans chapter 12, verse 20 and 21 to show that this idea of gloating when your enemy falls, that being a sin, is consistent throughout the Scripture. It's in the Proverbs or the Psalms, and it's in Romans. And I read this verse, and it says, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. And if you'll remember, if you were here, Sandra Brown said she didn't get this heaping burning coals on your head. That didn't seem consistent with God's command to feed and take care of your enemy and to bless him, you know. It sounds like revenge. You're trying to get vengeance on your enemy. Well, explanation has never been real good to me, you know, that God is saying, you know, feed your enemy and that way you can get even with him by heaping coals on his head, you know. So I've always thought there must be some other explanation. Well, the Wright clan, and I'm not exactly sure who it was, I think it was Claudia, sent me a thing that she says Alan has used in an earlier, and I don't think you remembered this, right?
Yeah,
when you were in class. This is this heaping burning coals on your enemy's head is an idiom. Does everybody know what an idiom is? It's an expression in a given culture or language that probably makes sense only in that culture.
That's right. It's okay. Cultural.
It's a cultural thing. Janice told me this, I didn't know it. But the English language is full of idioms.
And particularly the southern part of it.
The southern idioms. There are a lot of southern idioms.
I think every one of our subcultures has some of them.
Right,
and
yeah.
They kind of make it to the main culture.
Yeah. You know, I may say, I'm a day late and a dollar short. What does that mean to someone that's not from America, you know? It, to us, it means I didn't measure up. I didn't quite reach my goal or something, you know. But the English language is full of it. Another one I thought of, I read this in a book somewhere. If you're from another culture and you're in this United States driving and you see a sign that says dead end, dead end, what's dead got to do with the road? Why is that on a road sign, you know? So, and we use this to communicate all the time and don't think anything about it. So,
when I was young and worked, I worked with a German lady who wasn't very nice to me, and she was that way to some other people. And the boss said, she was a Christian, she said, I talked to her about it, and she said, just heap burning coals
on her head.
Yeah. And I didn't know what that meant, but I thought it meant be nice to her, and then she would start being nice to me, and that's what I did. And she did. Eventually.
Well, good. Because I think that's kind of what it means.
Yeah,
we're going to see that. According to the article that Claudia sent me, this is probably an idiom from Middle Eastern culture where they used fire pots. And a fire pot was, like a pan of fire in it, and it was portable. You could move it from one place in the room to another room in the house. And there's actually a reference to one in Jeremiah. I found this interesting. Let me turn there and read this. Jeremiah 36. This is where the king King Jehoiakim is burning Jeremiah's scroll. And in the 22nd verse, it says, it was the ninth month, and the king was sitting in the winter apartment with a fire burning in the fire pot in front of him. Whenever Jehoiada had read three or four columns of the scroll, the king cut them off with a scribe's knife and threw them into the fire pot until the entire scroll was burned in the fire. So here's an example of a portable heater in Middle East, okay? And so, you know, everybody carried everything. The women carried everything on their head, right? When you see that today in Africa, they carry big bundles on their head. So if your fire pot needed fire in it, you went to your neighbor, and he would replenish with fire, coals, your fire pot. And so basically it means provide him his needs. And to heap it is would be abundantly, to abundantly take care of your enemy. Okay, so instead of harming your enemy, it actually means blessing. But it's an idiom in a foreign or a Mid-Eastern culture that would be strange to us, you know.
So it really means provide warmth for it.
Yeah, there is a translation. A lot of the, I found this interesting, a lot of the paraphrases actually translated as referring to searing his conscience. Like, you know, I've heard that explanation all my life and never really liked it much, but there is a translation, and I think it was dated 1905, that actually replaces the idiom with the literal what it means. And it reads, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him water to drink and a fire besides for his needs, and then the Lord will repay you. And I thought about the NIV. If you replace the idiom in the NIV, it would say, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will fulfill his needs. So that's an explanation that I thought was interesting and I thought was worth sharing with the class. Because, and you know, and Janice, she's an English teacher, and so she's been dealing with idioms for years. She taught English to foreign students at UAH for two or three years. And some of the situations she got into with explaining idioms to her students were really hilarious, you know. My favorite story of idioms is she liked to prepare a southern meal for her class. And so we would have maybe 20 foreign students come over to the house one evening and have cornbread and black-eyed peas and a southern meal. And so, and she had students from South America and China, Taiwan, and Eastern Europe, all over. Egypt.
Lots of Muslim students.
Jordan. It's interesting when you get an Israeli and a Jordanian, or from Thailand and mainland China in the same room. You know, that's kind of interesting. But she was explaining to the class, she wanted them to get their plate, go through the line and get their food and sit down, find a place to sit. And she was speaking very fast, southern idioms, right and left, you know. And I was standing by two Chinese guys.
And they were from Taiwan.
Taiwan.
Yeah. Close enough. So, you can tell because they're a lot more westernized.
Yeah.
At that time.
Yeah. Anyway, as she was explaining this, one of these Chinese guys turns to the other and said, "What'd she say?" And the other one said, "I don't know." That's a perfect example, because she was saying, "Get in line." Well, what's a, you know, a line? That's a mark on a piece of paper, right? What is a line?
Well, most of them know that from university life, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a speed. More than anything.
You think you were confusing with the speed?
Yeah, oh, yeah, well, you know, they only get one thing at a time, and that was a flow.
Okay.
So, but they knew I'd take care of them, so, you know, let him foot.
Oh, okay.
That's the boys that brought us some rice wine.
Yeah, they brought Janice some wine, and Janice wisely said, I'm going to put this up because we have Muslims here. And so... That worked right out. Oh, yeah, put it up, don't show it, you know. So,
and I thanked them for it.
Yeah.
I was just thinking a couple of things, and I'm trying to make it brief. We had two Indian guys over to eat with us one time years ago, and one of them said he was a vegetarian, and we thought, okay, what can we have to eat? And this was like on the spur of the moment. They visited church, and we said, come home with us. Mm-hmm. And so we stopped by and got some things, and I made deviled eggs.
And they said,
what is this? And I said, deviled eggs. And one of them said, the devil's eggs?
Yeah, what you say is not what they hear.
No, we tried to explain. And then in New Zealand, we would tell people, we'd pick them up and carry them to church.
You'll put them on your back.
Pick us up.
Find that funny, too.
I think the interpretation of the keeping COVID file on their head for us would be, we'll let you borrow our space heater.
Yeah.
Make sure they have extra heat.
Yeah. I thought of, I used to watch Saturday night or Monday night football, and I can't remember who it was on with Howard Cosell, but he would always say, it ain't over till the fat lady sings.
Yeah.
Don Meredith. Don Meredith would say that, right?
Yeah.
And so somebody might say, it's all over but the shouting. And the other guy would say, nah, it ain't over till the fat lady sings.
And if what about someone, break a leg?
Do what?
Yeah,
break a leg.
Oh, now that's a good one. Be good. Ginger's four kids. Right here is one of them. When her older sister was a little kid, she was taking ballet lessons, and she was in a dance class, and she was in a performance. And Willa went
Lizard
over
was
there.
Was sick.
Yeah, she was.
In the hospital, yeah. And Willa went over to help Ginger.
Okay, so anyway, Willa was helping get Bella ready to go to the show where she was going to perform with her dance routine, and Willa said, okay, break a leg. And Bella started crying. She didn't want to break her leg. Very literal, you know.
So,
I guess that's enough of the idioms, but now we know when we communicate a lot with idioms. And
so did people back then.
Yeah. Okay. Last week we went over chapter 31. No, actually that was the week before. Chapter 32 through 37. We looked at Elihu. And we noted that the author identifies Job's sin as self-righteousness and justifying himself rather than God. We said that Elihu does three things that I like. He proves, or he uses Job's own words to convince him that he's sinned. He does a much better job than Job's friends with that. He defends God. And in defending God, he gave a lot of reasons why man might suffer other than punishment from God for his sins, okay? And so he uses words like, God may send suffering to warn us, to save us from going to the pit, to bring about repentance, to get us to repent. And he said, God, and that is one of my favorite verses in the whole book, God speaks to us in our suffering. God delivers us in our suffering. It doesn't say he delivers us from our suffering, but he delivers us in our suffering. I think that's very important. But I think he uses the word, he's wooing you once or twice. So we didn't read Elihu, but we jumped around a lot, if you remember. I encourage you to go back and read it through if you have time. But up until this point, we have read the first 31 chapters in class. But we didn't get a chance to read Elihu. And I want to... This is where God speaks to Job out of the storm. Let me get back to... to Job here. And a lot of commentary says God suddenly speaks from the storm. But if you read carefully what Elihu says and what Job said before that, you get the impression that they kind of see the storm coming, you know. So they're kind of building up to this climax where the storm is coming, and God speaks out of the storm. If you go back to what Job said in, let me just flip back here, chapter 26, he says, "He wraps up the waters in his clouds, yet the clouds do not burst under their weight. He covers the face of the moon, spreading his clouds over it." So he sees the clouds here. And then in 36, Elihu, 36 verse 27 and 28, he says, "He draws up the drops of water which distill as rain to the streams. The clouds pour down their moisture, and abundant showers fall on mankind." Who can understand how he spreads out his clouds? How he thunders from his pavilion. See how he scatters his lightning about him? So they're seeing the lightning coming, bathing the depths of the sea, and so on. Then in the next chapter, the one before, in 37, the whole chapter is describing a storm. Elihu is describing a storm. We won't read all this, but this is the chapter where he says, "God brings the clouds to punish men or to water his earth and show his love." So God doesn't do things. God often does things for multiple reasons. You know, I've thought about this a lot. If I pray for one thing and you pray for another, we're not both going to get our prayer answered, right? It ain't going to happen, you know. So God works all that out in his providence and in his sovereignty. But
you mean if we pray for opposing
things? Right, yeah. Okay. Opposed, I'm sorry. First, throw down at the bottom of this chapter, right before God speaks, he says, let me find it here. Chapter 37, verse 22. "Out of the north he comes in golden splendor." God comes in awesome majesty. So he sees the storm coming here. And then God speaks out of the storm. So, starting in chapter 38, he says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm." He said, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me." You remember, throughout the poem, Job has been demanding a trial, right? So
here it is.
Yeah, God is here. He says, "You spoke without knowledge." Elihu uses the same phrase. Job spoke without knowledge. And in a sense, Elihu put Job on trial. And Job didn't say a word, and now God speaks. And he says, "You darkened my counsel." Subtranslations say, "My defense." Some say, I've lost it here, my word. My providence, I think. "You darkened my providence." And to darken just means confuse, right? To muddle.
Can I ask?
Sure.
Question. When the Lord speaks to Job, do we know if his friends were there and heard it too?
I don't know if they heard the whole speech, but they were certainly there, and God spoke to them after he spoke to Job.
Okay.
So
maybe they all heard.
I would, if it were me, I would assume that they're standing there listening to God talk to Job, you know, and comprehending it.
Yeah.
Not like Paul with the when he was struck down on the road to Damascus, and the other guys didn't hear what was being said, you know. But I don't really know. I don't think anybody knows for sure. But I would assume that they're there, and they're witnessing the whole thing. So any other thoughts on that question? Let's see where I am here. To darken is to obscure or to confuse or to cloud. And Job, when he speaks again in 42, he says he obscured God's counsel. In 13, chapter 13, I said he wants a trial. And he says, I don't care who speaks first. You speak and I'll answer, or I'll speak and you answer. In other words, Job is saying, you put me on trial or I'll put you on trial, God. And, you know, in a court of law, it is the plaintiff that presents his case, and then the defendant presents his case. So the defendant gets to answer the complaint. Well, here, God says, I'm going to be the plaintiff. I'm not going to be the defendant. God is not going to be defensive or put on the defense for anything. And he doesn't give Job a chance. He gives Job a chance to answer, but by the time he gets through, Job doesn't answer. I think we would like for Job to have asked God his questions, all of the questions that he's been saying, and we would have liked for God to defend himself. But that doesn't happen. And, you know, a lot of commentary, they say, well, it's a big disappointment when you get to what God says and Job doesn't get to answer to any of his questions. Well, I think that's a characteristic of the sovereignty of God, okay? But we'd like to know why, after all his complaining throughout the poem, when God speaks, Job, he caves. He doesn't say, okay, now it's my time and I'm going to ask you questions. He doesn't do that. All the accusations of denying him justice and of tormenting him, they're forgotten. Job just falls silent. And so you want to, you look, if you're looking for something that God said to Job, I can't find it. It's not in something that he said. So it has to be something else that happened to Job because God spoke.
Isn't that a little like every knee will bow, every tongue confess?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he understood by the time God spoke.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I don't think it necessarily was out of fear.
Yeah.
I think it was out of a realization, and I've got this in my notes when we get to it.
Oh.
A realization that God's not punishing me. He's not punishing me for sin. He's been with me and he's been on my side all this time and he loves me. And so I think that's what Job realizes. You know, when God, the God of the universe, takes the time to come and speak to you personally, that's got to... I used to work with a bunch of military guys, and they say, when you get shot at, that's a life-changing event in your life. You know, when God speaks to you from a whirlwind, you're changed. And I think that's the reason Job suddenly is silent.
I like that God first tells him to brace himself as a man. Mm-hmm. Like, man up.
Yeah.
Man up and listen to me.
Yeah.
I also think that Job couldn't answer any of God's questions. I mean,
yeah.
He realized his own ignorance.
Yeah. I'm getting way away ahead of myself in my notes here, but God asks him 70-something questions, and Job can't answer any of those questions. And I think we know if you
read... He said that in the beginning, didn't he? When he said if I could go to a court with him.
Yeah.
He said he'd over.
Yeah, well, Job expressed earlier in the poem he was fearful of God just overpowering him. God is so terrible and awesome that he wanted an arbitrator between him and God. But let's read chapter 38, verses 4 through 30 through... We'll read 38 and 39. So can I get somebody to read say, half of 38, maybe four readers. Can I get some volunteers? Charlie, if you'll read down, say, to, I don't know, through 23.
Okay.
Who'll read the rest of the chapter? Janice? Let's read 38.
Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that darkened my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched the measuring line across it? Or what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together, and all the angels shouted for joy. Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the cloud his garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, when I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place. When I said, this far you may come and no farther. Here is where your proud ways halt. Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth shall shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment. The wicked are denied their light, and their upraised arm is broken. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. What is the way to the abode of light? And where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths to their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born. You have lived so many years. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or seen the storehouses of the hail, which I reserve for times of trouble, for days of war and battle?"
What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed, or the place where the east winds are scattered over the earth? Who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm, to water a land where no man lives, a desert with no one in it, to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass? Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of the dew? From whose womb comes the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from the heavens when the waters become hard as stone, when the surface of the deep is frozen? Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons, or lead out the bear with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, "Here we are"? Who endowed the heart with wisdom or gave understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of heaven when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together? Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in a thicket? Who provides food for the raven when its young cry out to God and wander about for lack of food?
Okay. I love the sarcasm. You know, there's a lot of sarcasm in Job. And, you know, in verses 4 and 5, it says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation, earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. You know, and then in I think it's 21, he says, "Surely you know you were already born. You have lived so many years." You know, and you wonder, usually when someone's sarcastic, there's a touch of bitterness in their voice. And I would love for us to know the tone of voice that God uses in speaking, because I can't imagine God being bitter, you know, but very sarcastic. And Job was very sarcastic with his friends. So sarcasm is a good literary device, I guess, to make your point. But I love the another one of my favorite verses here is in verse 12 through 15. He says, "Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment." He said, well, what is he talking about? Well, I thought this is what came to my mind, and I'm not sure. This is my interpretation of this. Okay. When I was a kid, we used to camp out. Me and I had two brothers, and about all you could do in the summertime, we didn't have money, so we'd camp out. And we'd go in up on a hill above the city of Jacksonville, where I grew up, and build a fire and roast marshmallows and lie on blankets and look for shooting stars all night. Well, the city of Jacksonville is in the valley in front of us, and at night you can see lights. You might see lights of a car on the road, but the details are hidden. It's out of sight. Okay? But we're east of the town. And when the morning comes, you can watch all of the features revealed. Okay, so it's like he says here, the earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment. And I thought about that. We used to just, you know, suddenly we can see a building over there in the field that you couldn't see at all at night. And you see tree lines and things like that. So the light, the morning brings, it shakes out the earth so that its features stand out. And he talks about, I love this idea that, let me find it again. It shakes the edges of the earth, shake the wicked out of it. You know, Job talked about that in an earlier chapter, how the wicked love the darkness and they operate at night. And he says something like, the morning is their night. Or their night is their morning, I think is what he says. Job says that. And here God says, the wicked are denied their light. Well, their light is darkness. There's a play on words here, you know. Their upraised arm is broken. So to me, it's little things like that that make the poetry so meaningful, you know. You might need to get a commentary and read, what are you talking about here, you know, because it's kind of obscure. But
Janice, what is that verse I remember you telling me one time to have nothing to do with the deeds of darkness?
I don't know. Does somebody know? I remember the verse, but I don't know where it was. Janice, do you know? Anybody?
I was just thinking... I think it's the same place where it talks about the darkness, and it says people get drunk at night.
Yeah.
You know, I got a good concordance here. I'll look it up. It's right here.
She'll find it.
The occasion was, it was someone was going to go, they were called to come and be on in Tekoa to be on like a murder trial or something.
Okay.
And they chose not to do it because of, you know.
Is something murder. I told you?
Janice and I were talking about it.
Okay.
And have nothing to do with the deeds of darkness.
Well, that sounds very familiar to me.
Yeah. It might be Peter. Let me see. Somebody may know. Is it Ephesians 5:11?
What is it?
Is it in Ephesians?
Ephesians 5:11. See what that says. Read it for the class.
It says, have nothing to do with the deep fruit. Fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them.
Okay, and the the New Testament is full of, and so are the Psalms and the Proverbs, this imagery of darkness and evil and light and the light revealing and driving out darkness.
Well, you know, John uses that. He says people, the people of darkness don't come into the light because it exposes them.
Because there's one reference to they're not even speak of the things done by those in darkness, or something close to that.
Yeah.
Or sounds like some of those words. I don't know if I got the point or not.
Now, I Googled this because I'm not an astronomer, but he says, can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? That's one of the that's the Little Dipper in one of the constellations, the Taurus constellation.
He speaks of three of them there.
The bear is Ursa Major, referred to as the Great Bear. I'm sure David Nance would know all this. He's an astronomer. Does anybody remember Orion? Orion. Recently? Orion?
Yeah.
Did you see the movie Men in Black?
Yeah. Yes.
You remember that?
All three.
You what?
All three.
All three? You saw all three?
She's a movie.
Okay. It's a science fiction movie, and the alien has a pet cat. And the cat has on its collar a stolen galaxy. And before the alien dies, he says it's in Orion's belt, meaning collar. Well, Orion is known as a hunter with a belt and a sword. So, you know, these detectives, these guardians of the galaxy are trying to find out what in the world is Orion's belt? How do you hide a galaxy in Orion's belt?
I think it's
but it's
Orion.
A cat. Orion. I mispronounced
it. I was thinking if we're reading this, you know, if you don't know anything, I bet you could ask some people, what's Orion? And they'd say that new amphitheater over there. Off the
Okay, let's read 39. Somebody read half that chapter and I'll read the last half.
Don't we go until like 15?
That's fine.
Do you know when mountain goats give birth? Do you watch when the doe bears her fawn? Do you count the months till they bear? Do you know the time they give birth? They crouch down and bring forth their young. Their labor pains are ended. Their young thrive and grow strong in the wilds. They leave and do not return. Who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied its ropes? I gave it the wasteland as its home, the salt flats as its habitat. It laughs at the commotion in the town. It does not hear a driver shout. It ranges the hill for its pasture and searches for any green thing. Will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will it stay by your manger at night? Can you hold it to the furrow with a harness? Will it till the valleys behind you? Will you rely on it for its great strength? Will you leave your heavy work to it? Can you trust it to haul in your grain and bring it to your threshing floor? The wings of the ostrich flap joyfully, though they cannot compare it with the wings and feathers of the stork. She lays her eggs on the ground and lets them warm in the sand, unmindful that a foot may crush them, that some wild animal may trample them.
She treats her young harshly as if they were not hers, and she cares not that her labor was in vain. For God didn't endow her with wisdom or give her a share of good sense. Yet when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at horse and rider. Do you give the horse his strength or clothe his neck with a flowing mane? Do you make him leap like a locust, striking terror with his proud snorting? He paws fiercely, rejoicing in his strength, and charges into the fray. He laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. He does not shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against his side, along with the flashing spear and lance. In frenzied excitement, he eats up the ground. He cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds. At the blast of the trumpet, he snorts, aha! He catches the scent of battle from afar, the shout of commanders and the battle cry. Does the hawk take flight by your wisdom and spread his wings toward the south? Does the eagle soar at your command and build his nest on high? He dwells on a cliff and stays there at night. A rocky crag is his stronghold. From there he seeks out his food. His eyes detect it from afar. His young ones feast on blood, and where the slain are, there he is. So, if I counted right, God is asking 53 questions to this point. Okay, 53 unanswered questions. In this chapter, he talks about the mountain goat in verses 1 to 4. God made him to thrive in a remote place away from man. The wild donkey in 5 through 12. God made him wild and free. I remember Janice and I, 2 or 3 years ago, we went to Lake Reno, and we drove down to Death Valley. And there in Death Valley, on the side of the road, we ran into some wild donkeys. You know, and I thought, how in the world do these things survive in this environment? But then you remember David Platt talked about the ostrich being dumb. The ostrich was made dumb by God, but fast, he can run fast.
Impressive in its run.
Right. Yeah, the horse is next. And then finally the hawk and the eagle. And God gave the hawk or the eagle good eyesight and the ability to soar above the earth. And Job can't do any of these things. He can't control them, much less create them and provide for them. I find it one interesting point, this end of 39 here. He says, his young ones feast on blood, and where the slain are, there he is, talking about the eagle. A lot of translations translate this eagle, and they also translate it vulture. So, you know, exactly what the bird is, we don't know, but I read a commentary once that said that in all of the Gospels, this is one of the places that Jesus may be paraphrasing. And back in Luke 17:37, he's talking about the coming kingdom, and he says, you know, one will be in the field, two will be in the field, and one will be taken, one left. And I forgot the other example, but one's taken and one's left. And the disciples ask him, where? And he says, what does that say? I forgot.
It's about the vulture.
Let me find it. Luke 17.
Where the eagle?
Yeah, 37. He says, where there is a dead body, there the vultures will gather.
Yeah.
Well, that's a paraphrase, a perfect paraphrase of what he says here. So, of course, they ask him where they're going to be taken, and they're going to be dead. So it kind of reverses. A lot of people use this passage for the rapture, but in this context, it's those that are taken may be put to death. They may pile up a bunch of dead bodies, you know. So, and I thought that was interesting anyway. I counted something like 53 questions here, and he asks him a lot more in chapter 41, another 20, I think. We have to remember that a lot of these questions God asked Job 3,000 years ago, over 3,000 years ago. And we know the answer to some of these questions now, don't we? If you've ever watched National Geographic, you know, some of them do research to learn the how long something waits before it delivers its young and things like that. So we know the answers to some of these questions. But I think God could come up with 53 questions to ask us that we can't answer.
We only know them because God chose to reveal them through the National Geographic or whatever, man.
But it interests me that he talks about the vastness of the universe and the constellations and the vastness of the earth. And at this time, science didn't have a clue how vast the universe was, did they? A lot of the things that we see are stars or galaxies. So the vastness of the universe is far greater than Job could even imagine. So,
some of the answers to these are not necessarily on the part of the animal or whatever. It's God that put whatever that was into them. It's not in and of themselves. It seems to me that may be his main point.
Yeah, God is the one that's did it. God made them, and he takes care of them. And Job can't even begin to do that.
You don't know how I did it, so you question it.
Yeah, and we still don't know how he did it.
But you know, I still defend Job somewhat.
Do what?
I said I still defend Job somewhat. I think he had a right to do a lot.
Yeah, I think we've
really
said that.
I really do. I think, I mean, I just don't understand where it was coming from.
And I think we'll see that in God's reply to him and his three friends at the end of the book. But, yeah, Job's not perfect.
No.
But he's better than the three friends in you know, his theology, I think. And I think one of the little videos we saw said Job is all over the place in this book. He's, one minute he's defending God's sovereignty, and the next minute he's defending or wanting an explanation from God for what he's gone through. So let's read.
I think that's the way God made us.
Yeah.
We're inquisitive about the facts. We like to understand, and that's what Job is doing.
Yeah.
Help me understand.
And I think one of the things that God can take that a lot better than he can arrogant ignorance. We got less than 10 minutes. Anything else about that we might pick up here next week? Because be honest with you, I taught this course 10 years ago, and I had 12 weeks, and I got 13 weeks now. Mm-hmm. So I'm not anxious to necessarily finish early. So we may pick up here with chapter 40 and finish God's comments to Job. Any other thoughts on?
We're not going to read 40 now.
Well, we can read it if you got. Yeah.
I find that Job just got put in his place with God asking him all those questions.
Yeah.
It's like,
well,
hey, maybe I'm not the main focus of what God's got going on.
Yeah.
I think I'd feel pretty little after that.
I've got this book that Becky brought me. I hadn't read it yet, but Janice has read some in it. And that's kind of what he says, you know. It's there's a lot of good. He says, if you ever read Jim McGuigan, he's a great author.
Yes.
And
speaker too.
A great speaker, yeah. Let me just we got time. Let me read you what he says here on page 18. He says, now this is jumping ahead to chapter 42, where God tells the three friends that what they spoke is not right about him, like what Job said is right. Okay? He refers to Job as his servant three times. He says, the friends finally came to believe that Job was a hypocritical sinner and God was punishing him for it, which was untrue. But they spoke truths about God's wisdom, power, and justice in support of what was untrue. So when we take their speeches as a whole, we are to judge them by where they were going with them. This helps us make sense of 42 verse 7, where God rebukes them for not speaking the truth about him, as my servant Job has. God was not denying that the friends spoke many truths. It's what they were doing with the truths that made them false witnesses. What is true to the friends is also true of Job. Job's bottom line was true, although he blundered on the way there. The bottom line for the friends was untrue, although they spoke truths on the way to it. So, but yeah, I think that God did put Job in his place. And I think Elihu kind of prepared him for it, because he don't say anything to Elihu either. So anyway, I'll try to share. He says things a lot better than I do. Okay. And we got 5 minutes. We get up 5 minutes early today.
I know. I know.
How are you?